Okay, so for those that are listening to the podcast, just want to remind you that we have no class next week, Thanksgiving week. And last time we were together, we were in chapter 13, and we got some good education there. We spent a lot of time talking about some important principles of biblical interpretation. We learned a little more about Saul and the course of his reign. And we said that it was possible that Saul actually hadn't done very much to fight the enemy until Jonathan's birth, until Jonathan grew up, at least not that we're told. The Philistines, I guess things had gone downhill to the point that the Philistines had even established a garrison of troops in central Israel. And Jonathan bravely attacked them while his dad really wasn't doing too much. And so thinking that the retaliation was going to be massive, the Israelite army was infected with fear, we said, and they started to flee even before any battle took place. So Saul made a major blunder because he was afraid of losing his popularity and because he was afraid of the enemy. And he made the big mistake of offering sacrifice himself, really taking the priest's role into his own hands. He didn't wait for Samuel. In fact, he kind of took it out on Samuel. He blamed Samuel in a roundabout way for not getting there in a timely fashion. So because of that, you remember Samuel said that Saul had behaved foolishly, and he told Saul, your kingdom is not going to continue. So Samuel then tells him news that he didn't want to hear, right? That God has sought for himself a man after his own heart in order that this new man might be the commander over the people of Yahweh instead of Saul. So as the chapter ends, though, we see that Israel's in a really desperate situation. They don't even have any proper weapons, right? Saul and Jonathan are the only men in the whole army that even have any metal weapons. So militarily and every other way, the Israelites are just totally outmatched by the Philistines. So that's where we are coming into chapter 14. And begin reading at verse 1. It says, now it happened one day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. And Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So we don't know how much time has elapsed, but the Philistines, if you remember, have been sending out these raiding parties just to harass the people in the region. So question that I have is, why didn't they do anything? They had amassed this massive army. So it's been suggested that God, in his providence, was really keeping the Philistines from striking a massive blow against the Israelites. And maybe they were just motivated by money. They didn't want to wipe out the Israelites completely because, if you remember, they're making a lot of money off them by lording it over them economically. So, but in any case, once again, the writer wants us to notice that Jonathan is the one who's taking the initiative again, while Saul is still very passive. And it's only Jonathan and his armor bearer there that are active in doing anything. The armor bearers were usually young men. Maybe they were 14 or 15 years old, a little bit older maybe, but not too much older than that. They were kind of an apprentice that would work for an officer, an important person, or a rich person who protected them among doing other duties. You couldn't be a man of war in the army of Israel until you reached 20 years old, but they would have these apprentice-type people. So his job, as we will see later, might have been to finish off the people that his master had wounded. So, you know, I walk through and I start whacking everybody, then my armor bearer is behind me, and he's giving the coup de grace to people as I walk by, right? So Jonathan, anyway, wants to move toward the enemy garrison, the little combat outpost, we would say nowadays, of the Philistines, but he doesn't tell his father. That's interesting. We don't know if it's a good thing or not. You know, it would seem from everything that's about to happen that this was a good thing and that Jonathan had really heard from the Lord and was fired up in his faith. But you know, it's usually not a good idea to plan attacks or execute attacks without your commanding officers knowing about it, right? But I think if there's a little lesson in there for us, it's that sometimes godly people shouldn't always let the wicked people know everything they're planning, right? Why give worldly people a chance to undercut your plans? And sometimes you shouldn't share all your plans with people because they might try to undermine you with their fear of failure. That you ever say, you know, speak some idea that maybe the Lord's given you, and then all of your, quote, friends come out and start giving you 10 different reasons why it's not going to work. You know, I think Jonathan was the type that just wouldn't listen to that. He said, come on, let's just go do it. I think he was of that spirit, but not so much his dad. As for Saul, where is Saul? He's back in his hometown of Gibeah, still with his force of 600 men. Now, you may remember that Saul originally had 3,000 men in his little army, but that number had dropped down to 600 because most of the men went home in fear when they found out what was coming against them. So what's interesting to me about this is that it seems that since he's still at this number of 600, nobody else has come to join his army either. It's interesting. He hasn't seemingly done any recruitment, and nobody has voluntarily showed up to say, hey, I'll help. But where precisely can we find Saul? This translation here that I'm using says he was in the outskirts of Gibeah. But the word more likely really means that he was in the edge, or the far extremity. So here's the great contrast again, right, between brave Jonathan and passive Saul. Rather than be exposed, like Jonathan's going to just, you know, hang himself out there, Saul is in the farthest or most protected place he can be, possibly all the way in the back or behind the city, right? So by contrast, Jonathan is daring. He's not afraid to take the fight to the enemy. He's virtually alone, and his father, the king, is in the protected city all the way in the back. And this was about, if I remember correctly, about 6 miles away. So Saul is 6 miles away, all the way in the back, behind the city, in the back of the city. So you get the picture. The Philistines, if they're going to attack him, they'd have to make it all the way through the city, break into the city, and get all the way to the rear of the city, to the regions beyond, to find Saul. And yet here's Jonathan and his one little friend, all by themselves, wanting to take the Philistines on. I mean, you couldn't have a more dramatic contrast. So it's this strange mixture that we see in Saul's life every time we read about him. The Jewish Bible readers would not have missed the picture that Saul is sitting under a pomegranate tree. It's interesting. That was a symbol of fruitfulness for them, maybe even a symbol of luxury. So he's sitting in judgment like a king, but he's giving a false impression of fruitfulness and blessing, which was totally wrong because this is a time of war, and a pomegranate was not a symbol of war. It was a symbol of ease and comfort. So you, if you're a Jewish person and you were reading this story, in your mind, you're thinking of another person who was, you know, giving direction to Israel, who was Deborah. So when you see Deborah the prophetess judging the people, actually not too far away from where Saul was sitting, actually, Deborah is also sitting under a tree as a judge and prophesying and encouraging the people, but she's sitting under a palm tree, which is very different because that was a symbol for them of victory and of justice. So here's Saul, who's supposed to be leading people in battle, and he's, you know, sitting under a pomegranate tree, a symbol of peace and prosperity. So another ominous note here, I don't know if you picked it up, but Samuel seems to be absent. Where's Samuel? Nowhere to be found. And so Saul is now traveling with one of the priests. And what priest does he have with him? He has this guy named Ahijah, who's the brother of Ichabod. Now, you remember Ichabod? Ichabod is the child that was born when the Ark of the Covenant was captured years before. And his name meant the glory is gone. The glory has departed. And then the writer mentions for you the line of Eli. And of course, Eli was the priest whose family line had had this doom prophesied against it by the Lord. So none of this is a good sign. Samuel's gone, but hey, I've got Ichabod's brother here to help me. So again, so that's a really bad sign. So this priest is wearing an ephod, and you're all scholars of Samuel now, so you know that that was the priest's garment, and it was probably the high priest's special ephod that had the stones inside it, the Urim and Thummim inside of it, so that they could ascertain the will of Yahweh. So what does this tell me? This tells me that Saul, whether through good intentions or superstition, or maybe a mixture of both, Saul is at least, you know, wanting to maybe seek God or have the possibility of seeking God if he gets into trouble. So in the absence of Samuel, maybe he wants to still be sure that he has a way of contacting the Lord, or maybe he's just being superstitious. Final thing to notice, so these three little verses are jam-packed with what they reveal about what a mess the army is in right now. Nobody realizes that Jonathan is missing. So up until just recently, Jonathan has been in command of a third of the entire army, but now nobody even sees him disappear. You know, he just walks out the door and nobody knows it. So all of these things are telling us that there is bad leadership in the camp of Israel. All right, so what does Jonathan do? Verse 4 says, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. So he's literally between a rock and a hard place, right? And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other, Sene. Those are actual real places that people were familiar with, and you could have, all these areas are pretty built up nowadays, but the Bozez means shining. So it was like a white chalk cliff, and if you had gone there, I don't know if you can still see it, but not too many years ago, you would have been able to still see these places. The other place means like an acacia tree. So people would have spotted these. You would have still, if you'd have gone there even in the 1900s, you would have been able to see where these cliffs were, because one had this chalky stone, so when the sun hit it, you could see it shining and so forth. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other one southward opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. What a great line. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you according to your heart. I like that kid too. Then Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So Jonathan and his armor bearer are sneaking through, and they're in this little valley. It's a valley of decision, really, for them, because they have to decide what are they going to do. The point is that Jonathan has snuck away, right? And he's in this valley where nobody can see him. Saul's lookouts can't see him, and the Philistines' lookouts can't spot him either. And he's, again, urging the young man to go forward. And Jonathan calls them uncircumcised. So for the Israelites, that was really a derogatory term that they used to call Gentiles many times, you know, unclean, or to show their disgust at the heathen peoples. Not all of the Gentiles were uncircumcised. You know, some of their relatives, the Edomites, the Arabs were. But by using this term, which we're going to continue to see in 1 Samuel, Jonathan is highlighting the fact that they, the Israelites, they are in covenant with Yahweh. And the Philistines, of course, are not. So that sign of circumcision, of course, being the marker that they're in covenant with God. So he's calling them that to kind of emphasize we are God's people and they aren't. David, you're going to see David using that same term, right, when he's talking about Goliath in a few chapters. Don't you love the faith of Jonathan, though, in verse 6? I love that. Nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. Do you notice here that Jonathan doesn't have a clear word from the Lord at all? This is not a story like Gideon. There is no angel, there is no prophet, there is no voice of the Lord that came to Jonathan and said, "Jonathan, arise and go and smite the Philistines," or something like that. Mm-hmm. He just got up and went, not having a word from the Lord, but just having a word of scripture that gave him faith. All he had was an understanding in his heart that, hey, we are God's people and he is for us and he wants to help us. And it's just in that naked faith alone that he got up and walked out of the camp with just one other guy without having any word of prophecy, just with the knowledge that God had delivered Israel in the past. And just that was enough to give him faith and courage. What a lesson that is for us. You know, when we don't have a specific word, right? Sometimes we don't do something because, like, oh, I need to hear from God on this. Yeah. Mm. And sometimes God is waiting for us to just arise because he's God and he's going to back us. I don't mean that we should do foolish things on that basis, but here's a man that rose up and just decided to do because he said, hey, we're the people of God and God's going to help us, so let's go for it. And he didn't need an angel like to come like Gideon did and kind of give him a kick and say, come on, you got this, right? So I love that. Nothing hinders God from saving by many or by few. And that line really, I think, is designed to make us think of Gideon. Maybe that's exactly what Jonathan was thinking of. Maybe he was remembering the story of Gideon, right? God used Gideon's little army of 300 to save the people. But even though Saul's got twice that many, Saul's got 600, he's, where's Saul? He's camping out, munching on pomegranates, right? So, and here's Jonathan, who's willing to take on an entire outpost with two guys. So, the armor bearer also has great faith, and this really brings home to me that faith and courage, just like fear, they're contagious. Jonathan's faith and his courage were contagious. And actually what this young man says to Jonathan is really wonderful. In Hebrew, it doesn't really translate well, but what he literally said to Jonathan was, "I am with you like your heart is with you." What an awesome way to phrase something, right? Jonathan, let's go do it because I am with you just as much as your own heart is with you. I love that. I love that loyalty, that he was willing to follow him anywhere and do anything. So Jonathan chooses the harder option to be his sign that God is with him. Isn't that interesting? In case you were reading this saying, well, what's the sign? The sign was that if they tell us to do the harder thing, that's our sign from God. So we can't say he made it easier on himself. Jonathan says, right, if the Philistines tell us to climb up to them, we'll take that as a sign from God. And it's interesting, his thinking, because that probably would at least make sure that they get in the door. If they get inside the door, they can do more damage. Plus, if they're bringing them up, it means that they're not really as ready for an attack as if they were ready to run out and attack him. So it was more difficult personally for him to attack that way, but it would seem that they had a greater chance of success if it happened that way. So there's also a pun there, which we would miss, but it's very obvious in Hebrew. He says that God has given them into our hands, and that's actually a play on his name. Do you remember we said Jonathan's name means given by Jehovah? So the words that he is using to say God has given them is the exact same words that make up his name. So as you're reading the story, you can kind of imagine Jonathan kind of saying this like with a smile on his face because he's making a pun based on his own name to say that God has given the Philistines to them. So verse 11, they said, all right, we're going to do this. Let's do this plan. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they've hidden. And then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you something, or literally teach you something. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. So I want to see this in a movie. You know, I really believe there's probably almost no good Bible movies, right? They all shift the story around too much, but I'd love to see this story. So maybe they wave or something to get the Philistines' attention, and you see the mockery that's coming at them, right? Do you remember that in the last chapter, most of the Israelites had fled. They were actually literally hiding in holes and caves. So notice, like I said, that this was really going to be hard. They are literally climbing up this hill on their hands and knees, but they did this like, you know, action heroes. But that's how steep the ascent was. So we don't get all the details here, but once they open the gate, Jonathan and his armor bearer are able to get in. No doubt they are empowered by the Spirit of God. And as I said about the armor bearers, Jonathan is striking them, and then the young man's coming up behind him, finishing them off, and they were able to overcome 10-1 odds. They took out 20 guys. In a space that's, you know, probably like half the size of this room, maybe, through the power of God. So you could see how that would happen, right? If you've got two guys mocking them, they go up and kill those two guys. These men are probably spread out. They're not expecting, and you know, to be attacked inside their own gate. And so as these men are coming out of their little tents or whatever, Jonathan and his armor bearer are just going around from tent to tent, killing these guys probably before they even knew what happened. So, but now, in verse 15, God responds to Jonathan's naked faith. It says in verse 15, there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who's gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. And so Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Let me explain that, because this is very interesting about Saul's reaction. So, but first, notice the result. So all of a sudden, there's something supernatural that's happening in the region. So in response to Jonathan's faith and wanting to give Israel a large victory, right? God sends an earthquake that everyone in the area can feel. So you have the Philistine raiding parties that are running around attacking people. They're out in the field and they also feel it. And in verse 15, it says the trembling is very great. But that's not what it says in the Hebrew. It literally says in the Hebrew that this is a trembling of God. And literally, it literally says a trembling of Elohim. And this is very mystifying to me, because the word Elohim is clearly in the Hebrew text. I looked. And so I honestly don't know why the translators left it out. Because it literally says there was a shaking of, or maybe from, Elohim. So that tells me that this was a divinely caused phenomenon. And the result is what? That God supernaturally, by his Spirit, maybe by the presence of his angels, he causes the Philistines to be seized with terror. So now we've got the detail that Saul and his men, they have their little lookout tower, and they're back in Gibeah watching, and all of a sudden, they can see that the Philistines are like running all over the place in different directions. So maybe they believed, right? It makes sense, that the supernatural power of Israel's God was acting against them. Now, if you're one of these Philistines, then you probably had heard stories from back in your father's or grandfather's day of how, remember their great god Dagon had to bow down in front of the Ark of Yahweh, the God of Israel. So these guys, they're in the land of Israel. They're on foreign soil to them. Now, all of a sudden, crazy things are happening. Your garrison's wiped out and everything starts shaking. So if you're that Philistine, you're going to assume, oh, the God of the Israelites has awakened and he is against us. And so they just begin to panic. that scattering of their enemies is exactly what God had promised that he would do for Israel all the way back in the Torah, all the way back when God gave the law to Moses. I've given you the quote there in Deuteronomy 28. This is a verse many of you have read, I'm sure. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They will come out against you one way, and they will flee before you seven ways, or flee in seven directions. And so this is one of those situations, but it's a supernatural thing. It's not because they were so brilliant at war. How embarrassed would they have been to find out it was only two guys against an army, but a divinely caused panic. Now, notice Saul. Saul's reaction is not to say, "This is awesome." Saul's reaction is, "Hey, who did this? Let's take the roll call and find out who's missing." So, you know, was he jealous for glory? I mean, you have to wonder, right? Isn't that a strange reaction? In any case, they find out pretty soon, right, that Jonathan and the armor bearer are missing. So now Saul wants to inquire of the Lord because he's brought the priest, and he has the priest come with the ark. Now, apparently, they had gotten into the habit of taking the ark with them again out to battle. Do you remember that the ark has been resting ever since the Philistines and the Israelites were playing around with the ark in ways that they should not have been? The ark has been resting in this little village, Kiriath Jearim, probably for about 60 years by this time. It's been resting, and people have been smart enough to leave it alone since Samuel was a young man. But now they take it out to battle. So I have to wonder if maybe they are falling again into habits of superstition, or maybe Saul is thinking that he wants his priest that he's brought with him to be able to use the stones to inquire of the Lord in front of God's direct presence in the Ark of the Covenant. Very possible. So if we're Jewish people and we're reading this in the ancient world, all of a sudden now we're excited because it seems like maybe Saul is finally wising up. He's finally doing a good thing. He's going to inquire of Yahweh. And so the writer is really setting you up, thinking that, okay, Saul is finally maturing as a leader and so forth. But you look into verse 19 and you find your hopes dashed. Saul is just going from bad to worse. He hears this tremendous noise from the camp of the Philistines and he pauses. He tells the priest to stop. He's like, "Don't bother seeking Yahweh." In other words, Saul is saying, you know, I think we got this in the bag. It sounds like whatever's happening out there, it sounds like they're already being slaughtered and they're already fleeing. So we don't need to ask any help from Yahweh or find out his opinion on the matter. So, and that obviously is a very carnal reaction for Saul to take. He feels that seeking the Lord in a situation like that is very unnecessary, which is obviously foolish. There's a great contrast there that we're going to see with David, because you know that later on, David was going to be famous for seeking God all the time, even when he knew how to act in the natural. And Saul was also violating the law, because when they were in a battle situation like this, when they were outnumbered and so forth, the priest was supposed to come out and speak to them and encourage them. So again, Saul feels free to disregard God's law. He says he's above that. He knows what to do. He doesn't need to hear from the priest. He doesn't need to seek God. So verse 20, God's very merciful regardless. It says, "Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. Moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Philistines. I'm sorry, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in the battle. And so the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth Aven." So God really did move for the people that day. So when Saul and his gang of 600 men get to where the noise is coming from, they can see that the Philistines are actually fighting each other in their confusion and panic. How did that happen? We don't know. But if you are familiar with some of the stories of the Old Testament, then you may recognize that this is, if I could put it this way, this seems to be one of God's favorite tactics. Israel was always small, usually outnumbered when they went out to battle, and yet this is a tactic that you see God using to help them over and over again. So this happened in the story of Gideon, right? That was the thing about Gideon and his 300. Sure, they did some fighting, but most of the damage was caused in the story of Gideon by the enemies fighting each other. And there was also the story of Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles, where you have the same story. Israel was invaded by this massive host from many different countries, and they ended up completely destroying each other. So what does God do? He supernaturally creates a confusion and hatred within the enemy's camp, particularly when you've got people of different nationalities and so forth together against Israel, and he causes them to destroy themselves and destroy each other. So here's my little prayer tip for tonight. You may want to pray for that sometime when the enemy's coming against you. You know, just pray for the Lord to send confusion in the enemy's camp and let them wipe each other out. So am I allowed to say that? I don't know, but it's going out on the internet. So you will even see this happening at the end of the age. So if you go into Ezekiel 38 and you see the famous battle there of Gog and Magog, and the enemies of Israel are invading Israel in the last days, one of the ways that, not the only way, but one of the ways that God will destroy the enemies of Israel is by turning them against each other. So in Ezekiel 38, it says, "I will call for a sword against Gog throughout all my mountains, says the Lord God. Every man's sword will be against his brother." So, you know, the Lord says, "Hey, this tactic's working pretty good so far. We might as well stick with it all the way until Jesus comes." So, not only do the Philistines kill each other, but you see the tide turns now. You know, when people see success, a lot of times they change sides, right? We know that's human nature. So not only do the Philistines kill each other, but the Israelites who have been with the Philistines, maybe even collaborating with them, they now turn on the Philistines and they are fighting for Israel once again. And finally, you have this other bunch of Israelites. These are the ones who had fled to a different part of the country to get away from the Philistines. They find out apparently about what's going on and they come back and they join in the fight. So a supernatural deliverance from God. It says the Lord saves Israel that day. And that's the exact same wording. The precise words that it gives us, the Bible gives us, when it says that he saved them out of Egypt. So this is all meant to demonstrate for us that this is a supernatural deliverance. And so I think the writer really deliberately uses the exact same words from the story of the Red Sea. Because it's very dramatic. It's a very dramatic, total turnaround that actually even shifts the balance of power. And when this happens, Saul and Israel are on a much better footing because, you know, the Philistines have these outposts in the precise middle of their country where they can control a lot of what's going on there. And so the Philistines are getting pushed back towards their own land. So verse 24, this is a long chapter, so we're not going to get through the whole chapter tonight. But verse 24 says, "The men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies.' So none of the people tasted food. Now all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Therefore, he stretched out the hand of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened." Got a sugar hit, right? "Then one of the people said, 'Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats food this day." And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now, how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now, would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines?'" So we'll have to stop here and not do the whole rest of the chapter, but notice again, here again is the foolishness of Saul. So there's a great contrast between Jonathan now, his perceptivity, right? Jonathan's got wisdom for a young man. Saul is foolish. Just like, again, the contrast between the courage of Jonathan and the passivity, even the timidity of Saul. So first, Saul places the people under a truly foolish oath. You know, if you're swinging a sword all day, you could use a few calories, right? So, but he says, no, nobody can eat anything all day until I have vengeance, right? So Saul disobeys God's law, right? But he has no problem making his own laws and commandments and oaths. And it's interesting because God gives us laws that if we obey them, our lives are blessed and strengthened. Human leaders can give oaths and laws that actually weaken people and make it more difficult for them to defeat the enemies that they need to defeat. So it's just a very interesting contrast there. So
Jesus said, "Don't you whitewash tombs and do the same thing, but things make it wounds that you yourself can't heal."
Yeah. So, yep. Yeah. You put intolerable burdens on people, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So notice that like all the people were faint and Jonathan is revitalized. Did you also notice that Saul is speaking of vengeance and he refers to the Philistines as his own enemies? Now, where did that come from? So again, you know, he's made it personal. Those are two very telling statements about Saul and about how he's going to conduct business. See, a little bit of a shift has already happened in Saul's thinking where it's no longer about the enemies of God or about the enemies that are harassing the people of God, right? Did you catch that? It's no, nobody can eat until I take vengeance on my enemies. That's a very bad shift in any leader. When you see that, that's a danger sign. And that's one of the problems that all human leadership needs to guard against. You know, the mission is no longer up here. Your own sense of entitlement or your personal motivations, you know, ascend to a place of priority higher than the mission that got you appointed to that spot in the first place. And then finally, Jonathan says something that we're meant to reflect on. He says something really ominous. He says, Saul has troubled the land. That's a very heavy statement. So if you're reading this for the first time, you know, you're a Hebrew student of the Bible, all of this is the moment at which you would hear the background music going dun dun dun. This is the moment. My father has troubled the land. Now we don't find that Jonathan was a prophet as far as we know, but just because of his own leadership skill and his own wisdom, he can see that something very dangerous has happened in the spiritual atmosphere. That word trouble in Hebrew, it means to stir up. This is the old-fashioned meaning of trouble in English also. Like when you disturb water, right? So they would have said troubling the water. So when you disturb water and now the water's moving, it's got ripples in it because you disturbed it. That's what trouble means. So in the figurative sense that Jonathan is using it, disturbing the land means you have stirred up things. You have stirred up people. You have stirred up situations in a bad way. And maybe we would say, thinking about it in terms of spiritual warfare, that Saul has troubled the spiritual atmosphere. In other words, Jonathan is telling you, I recognize now that my father has set in motion some really bad things in Israel. Because Jonathan is seeing the fruit of his father's leadership, which is going to cause catastrophic problems and loss of life for the Israelite people. And Jonathan is wise enough to notice that. I would suggest that he was absolutely right. He was seeing prophetically, even if he's not a prophet. He probably should not have said that out loud, right? Not just because it was his father, but because it was not wise for him to denigrate leadership like that in front of people. And so it's kind of almost like we don't ever find that Jonathan was trying to overthrow his father, but it was not a good thing to come out and say, my father has disturbed the nation. It's not smart, right? Not helpful. That word troubled, though, that was a loaded word in the Bible. So if we were Hebrew Bible readers from back in the day, we would know that this word has a, if you'll pardon the pun, a troubling history, right? Because centuries before, this was the word that Joshua had used in the story of Achan. Do you remember the man Achan? Achan was the man that disobeyed God, and when they attacked the city, he kind of secretly hid this contraband in his tent that he wasn't allowed to keep. And when he did that, that brought Israel under God's judgment, and Israel was defeated with a great loss of life by a tiny little town. And so Joshua said, you know, you've troubled Israel. So committing a sin like that, a hidden sin, it caused Israel to be defeated and suffered greatly. And now Jonathan is saying, my father has troubled Israel. So if you heard that, you would have immediately thought of that story of Achan, who by a little sin caused all of Israel to be defeated. And that's powerful foreshadowing. It's brilliant writing, really, because it's powerful foreshadowing that lets you know, if you hadn't ever read the story before, that lets you know that Saul is going to, by his life, cause Israel to suffer greatly. So next time we're together, we will see the last straw. What is the final act of disobedience on Saul's part that will cause God to send Samuel down to the little town of Bethlehem and anoint the next king who would be the man after God's own heart. So this is this statement of Jonathan saying, you know, my father's troubled Israel is the setup for the final big moment that causes the pronouncing of doom against Saul's kingdom. So scary, right? Yeah.
Why do you think Jonathan wasn't afraid to speak so openly about that? That seems like back then, especially, a common sense thing not to do.
Yeah. Good question. Question is, why wasn't he afraid to speak out? Is that the question? Yeah. So I think because Jonathan still had the mission in mind. He was caught up in the zeal. Right? He was caught up in the zeal of the mission. He wasn't just blindly saying, my father is foolish or senseless. He was saying, hey, if we had eaten, just think of how many more Philistines we would have wiped out. He was still fired up about the reason why they were there in the first place. But with Saul, it had become about vengeance on my enemies. But Jonathan is still like, hey, we have to still free our people. Think how much land we could have taken back from the Philistines if we had just been wise about how we were making war today. So I don't think he had any evil intent against his father, but he was so zealous for that mission of victory that you know, he just didn't have any restraint.
Why he's not a more popular person in the Bible, following such a strong sense of God's way and things like that?
Well, I think he is a very popular figure. Yeah, I think he really is. I think, you know, not only because of his courage and his zeal, but because of his friendship and his humility and his willing to serve the new king that was coming up. I think he's a very beloved person. I mean, how many of us would do that? I mean, he's next in line, right, to be the king. He's the crown prince, so to speak. But he will go, as we'll see in a few chapters, he'll go to David and say, listen, I know that you're going to be the king. And he gives David his armor and everything. I mean, it's a powerful statement. And I can't imagine the spiritual and emotional maturity that this man must have had to recognize and love and help someone who is going to take what, I mean, he could have said, hey, that's my place, right? Now, there would be other survivors of the family who did not have a noble character like Jonathan, and they fought against David. There was civil war after Saul's death. You know, I think a lot of times, you know, Christians, we think that, okay, David took over, hooray. But it wasn't like that. You know, David only had a small piece, and there was a 7 years civil war until he ruled over all Israel. But if Jonathan had lived and survived, the story would have been very different. It's kind of a fascinating Bible what if. But I admire that character so much. There's very few of us, even as you know, as Christians, I think that could do that for a successor, right? Because human flesh is like, hey, that's mine. I mean, who is he? This upstart? He's a shepherd. He's nothing. Who does he think he is that he can, you know? And then you would go out and, you know, kill Samuel or whatever for doing, you know what I mean? I mean, that would be fallen human nature at work. I just think he's a wonderful guy. He's just a man of a beautiful spirit. There's very few like him in Scripture, for my money. Yeah, Nina. Well, they would have their little watchtowers, but they would at some point they would. Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, your lookouts are probably, you know, sentries that are a little farther away. You know, they would have scouts here and there that would probably go and report back and say, hey, these guys are fleeing in all different directions. So yeah, we're not really given that level of detail. But at some point, you know, as they were fleeing in all these different directions, they would have been noticed probably. We just don't know. Yeah.
Do you think that that Jonathan was present when Samuel was rebuking his father?
Do I think Jonathan was present? It's possible. Some of those conversations between Samuel and Saul seem very private. They're only in the Bible because maybe Samuel wrote them down, or Samuel told Nathan what happened or something like that. And so that's how it got in the Bible. Sometimes these guys would always have their right-hand man with them, their general Abner. So maybe Abner and Jonathan were there with him and heard the whole thing. You know, there's no way to know. It's an interesting question, right? Because when we get into the next chapter, you know, it looks kind of private. It looks at some point that there were just the two of them having the very, very famous conversation. Is a very, very famous verse, you know, that Samuel. There's some very famous verses, you know, in the next few chapters, and I think it was private, personally. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, Francis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, good question. Good question. Mm-hmm. The priest. So the question is why was it all right for David to eat that bread? That bread, I think, had already been. We'll go back into that story. That bread was put before God's presence, and then it was taken out of God's presence. After the day went by. So it was probably old, and it was probably also the case that it was a situation of mercy or necessity, and which is kind of Jesus' point when Jesus is talking about in the Gospels. He said, did you ever read what David did when he and his men were hungry? So it's a little different scenario. You know, Saul violated his conscience and really overstepped the boundary in a major, you know, high-handed way, which he ought never to have done. In David's case, he's eating bread which had probably already been taken away from the holy place and so on. So it's a great question. Interesting. There's another similar situation there where David's relationship with the Lord is very interesting, because David was really, in many ways, living a grace relationship with God like we are today. There's a very tantalizing, perplexing line in there when David takes the ark into Jerusalem, and it says David went and sat before the Lord. So it's like, how did he do that? You know, was he like literally sitting in front of the ark? If so, he should not have been there. And yet God allowed that and welcomed that because of his heart. So, yeah, great, great question. Yeah, Jack. I'm sorry. Right.
A man after God's own heart.
Yes.
So again, it's a heart issue, right?
Right.
He got to do things in the new covenant before the new covenant.
Yeah, I really believe that David was such a picture of the new covenant that he enjoyed a lot of those experiences. And in fact, people like David, people like Abraham, they actually had an understanding, and anybody could, but you know, because of the way they lived in the closeness with God, they received revelation of the gospel. Not the particulars of the gospel, but for example, in the Psalms, right, David understands that righteousness and sin are things that God credits to us or that he sometimes doesn't count to us, which is a very powerful New Testament concept. And in fact, Paul uses that in Romans. Here, Paul is trying to explain the gospel, how God simply gives you righteousness as a gift and refuses to count sin to you. And he's pulling it from David, who realized those truths 1,000 years before. It's really powerful. So you're exactly right. David, because of his closeness with God, received a New Testament understanding of how we interact with God. Maybe that's what enabled him to go and sit down in front of the ark without being cooked to a crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One question that I have this way is, even though they ask for a king and God is teaching them the hard way, he still offers some victory within it, right?
Right. And yeah, it's very true.
And could it be that God allowed it to be Jonathan because at this point, could have been somebody else, Saul would have killed him?
More
grace from his father because it's still his son.
Yeah, that's a fantastic observation. So the question is, you know, God in his grace allowing these victories to come through Jonathan, because Jonathan was probably the least likely person that Saul would have wiped out. Because you see there in the text, Saul's first reaction to the possibility that some catastrophe has struck the Philistines, his first reaction is to find out, okay, who's missing? Who did this? Right? Because he didn't give any orders. And I think also that God, in his mercy, despite all the passivity of Saul, as he's, you know, enjoying his pomegranate juice, like chilling out, God was still very eager for his people to be delivered. And so here he finds, a young man in his 20s maybe, who is saying, let's go for it. Come on, just you and me. You're my armor bearer, so you have to do what I say. So come with me, and let's the two of us go attack some Philistines, even if nobody else does it. I mean, it really is an astounding story. And Jonathan is a relatively minor character, right? I mean, he's well known, but in the story of the Old Testament, he's a relatively minor character. So this episode, unfortunately, does not get the play that I think it deserves. Because this was the beginning, I think, of the real shattering of the Philistines' power in that part of the country. So, when you get David's kingdom and then Solomon is the Israelite kingdom at its greatest extent, none of that is possible without this. I mean, you cannot have the Philistines camping out here and there all over the middle of your country and have dominion over your own country. So Saul is, I think, disliked enough in Scripture that we don't get an account of many of the other things, you know, that he and Jonathan did. At the end of this chapter, which we'll see next time, you know, God just kind of gives us a list. And he fought these people all the days of his kingdom. So there was a lot of fighting later on. I personally do feel that he didn't do much until Jonathan came on the scene, because we don't see... We don't hear about it happening before then, and we see Jonathan taking the initiative. And even as late as, so let's say if Saul was anointed, at age 30 or whatever. I mean, how old could Jonathan have been? 10? So there is a long period of years in which not much has happened. And the Philistines have been able to establish a military presence up the spine of central Israel. And this event is the beginning of the real breaking of the Philistine power that makes a strong kingdom possible. So, yeah. Anybody else? How many of you still don't like Saul? It's just, it's remarkable to me how much mixture there is in this guy. You never know on a given day, is he going to be brave? Is he going to do nothing? Is he going to be bloodthirsty? Or is he going to just sit around and munch pomegranates? Is it really fascinating, fascinating, unstable character? But his name was an everyday reproach because his name means asked for. So every time somebody would even refer to King Saul, there was a reminder in Hebrew, every time you mentioned his name, this is what we asked for. It's very powerful, right? It's a very powerful lesson. And David's name, on the other hand, means beloved. So,
no. Why I never thought of it, but why couldn't I just use Jonathan then? I mean, obviously, love David, but you're already kind of seeing evidence of his heart and his, maybe not pathetic, but not.
Yeah, we really don't know. I mean, God had already. You kind of know, like if we're Jewish and we're reading this, we already know. Like, it's hard for us, right? Because we've had these books for thousands of years. But let's pretend that we're ancient Jewish people and we're reading all of this for the first time, right? We already know, because we've read Genesis, that God has made a choice that someday Judah will be the leader. So we already kind of know that this is going to end. The kingdom will not stay with the tribe of Benjamin. We just don't know if the transition will be a good and wholesome transition or whether it will be a miserable transition. And it was a miserable transition. Why did this happen? You know, we don't know. We just don't know. I think Jonathan, it looks like he would have been a wonderful king. He was more noble in many ways than David was. When we get into their relationship and you talk about how the covenants that they made with each other, it's very powerful. So you see the hearts. You see how powerful a godly friendship can be. And if that friendship hadn't been there, the situation would have been even more of a mess. It's very sad when you think about the end that he met. I won't give it away, but you know, he was loyal to the end. So, yeah, good stuff. Anybody else? All right. Thank you, guys. Don't forget, we are not meeting next week. Tell all your friends.